Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Web Sleuth Radio, my friends. My name is Tricia Griffith. I am the proud owner of WebSleuth.com, one of the best, if I do say so myself, one of the best true crime discussion forums on the internet. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking with Patrick McStay. Mr. McStay's son, daughter-in-law, and two grandchildren disappeared in February 2010, up and disappeared. And tragically, their bodies were found a few years later. They had been murdered. And Joey McStay, one of his dear friends, is going on trial for that murder. We're going to talk to Patrick McStay in just a moment. But right now I have a bit of an update for you on Kyron Horman. Remember a few weeks ago, the police said, hey, we've had a couple of tips and we're going to go search this area in Portland. Now, Kyron was the 7-year-old boy who disappeared from his school June 4th, 2010. No trace of him has been seen since then. Okay, a few weeks ago they did that search. Nothing came up of the search. Well, now they started to search again, going into places that they couldn't get to at the last search. But here's kind of the weird twist. The people, the law enforcement agencies searching for Kyron Horman didn't let the media know. But guess what? The media found out because all the neighbors saw them, and boom, the phone calls come in. It's just, it does no good, law enforcement, to try and hide these things when you're out in the open like that. Anyway, according to somebody who lives close by who did not want to be identified, the police are asking property owners for permission to search their properties before they start rappelling down a steep embankment. That embankment is covered by blackberry bushes and eventually leads down to a little creek. And they're trying to get into these areas, like I said, that they couldn't get into before. And I haven't heard anything about the search. I haven't heard if they found anything. Apparently this, again, based on tips on what the law enforcement feel are legitimate tips in the Kyron Horman case. So we'll definitely keep you updated on that. Just a little bit of news in the Dylan Redwine case. We know his father, Mark, has finally been arrested for his murder. And last I read, Mark was fighting extradition. What a shock. This guy's ego is so out of control. And like his ex-wife, Dylan's mom, Elaine, said last week on the show, there's no way he'll plead out. His ego won't allow him, so he's fighting extradition. He's just going to make it as hard as possible for law enforcement and the courts to convict him. He's in Washington State, I believe, and they're trying to get him back to Colorado. Okay, joining me now is a man I greatly admire, Patrick McStay. Patrick's son Joey, his wife Summer, and their two children, Gianni, 4 years old, and Joey Jr., 3 years old, just up and vanished from their Fallbrook, California home on February 4th, 2010. And like I said earlier, tragically, they were found murdered. They were buried in the desert near Victorville, California. They were found November 13th, 2013. And then about a year later, on November 7th, 2014, the police announced they had arrested Charles Chase Merritt, and that's Joseph McStay's business partner, and they have charged him with murder. Now, jury selection is scheduled in San Bernardino for September 18th, and the trial is tentatively scheduled for September 25th. Now, I say tentatively because anything could happen. He could throw in another wrench into the system. I'm talking about Merritt, Chase Merritt here, because he's done that a lot. But let's welcome Patrick McStay. Mr. McStay, thank you for joining us tonight.
Hi, Trish. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. And I think that's what everybody wants to know. You've been through hell and back. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm my days, good days and bad days. It's the fear I have now is, you know, the upcoming trial. So,
well, if you don't mind, Patrick, let's just kind of review for those who are listening and maybe may not be fully aware of the details of this case. Joey and his family disappeared. If I understand correctly, it kind of looked like they were just getting ready to do a few things, maybe eat dinner or whatever, and just walked out of the house. And then the law enforcement tries to tell you, and stop me if I'm wrong, that, oh, we saw the Joey and his family crossing the border. They're alive in the border. Is that what they told you?
Basically, yeah. What they did is first I ran across the emails where Summer was trying to buy Rosetta Stone CDs in Spanish, and I turned that over to them. And then they found a, and they went and had the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They had them run a, they went through the video of all of the border camera down in San Ysidro, which is, you know, down there at San Diego area. And they ran that, and they ran, they came across this family. It looked like a family of four. A mother walking with a child and a father walking with a child going across the border into Mexico at 7 o'clock on the night of February the 8th. Now, they tried, they then linked that to the emails that I gave them about her trying to buy the CD, and then they also found that somebody had been on my son's computer on the 28th of January, and they had looked to see what was required for children, taking children in Mexico. They took those three things, linked them together, and said they went to Mexico. Said that was them in the video, and they went to Mexico.
And that was it. They were, they felt like the case had been solved, right?
Well, you know, the funny part about it is, they were, we know that the last thing we know of Joey and the family is February 4th, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We then know, I find out on the 9th, I call my youngest son, Michael, try to get him to go down there. He's too busy. He finally goes down on Saturday the 13th. He finds the house, you know, some things at the house suspicious. But he decides he's going to wait till Monday the 15th because this is a Valentine's weekend and he thinks they could have taken a short vacay, he called it, vacation. And that's just not even logical. But anyway,
right.
He has Chase Merritt meet him at the house on the 13th. Mikey then goes in the house. He goes through a window in the back. It's unlocked. Gets in the house. Opens the door. Chase goes in. They find rotting eggs in a carton on the counter. Rotting fruit. They find bowls of popcorn sitting on futon, uneaten. He still doesn't call the police till Monday. So he calls them on Monday. The sheriff comes out. They go in the house. And on missing person cases in California, they're handled, or San Diego, they're handled by homicide. So he calls homicide. Homicide sends a detective out. He comes out, looks through the house, finds what they found. He then says, okay, I'm going to go get warrants. It's going to take a while to get warrants. This is on Monday the 15th. Okay, he leaves. They don't secure the house. They don't put crime tape up.
Oh.
They don't do anything. Okay, they just lock the, you know, Michael locks the doors, you know. That's it, basically. Okay, now, people are in and out of the house from the 15th to Friday the 19th when the police return with the warrants. Now, the funny part about this, now the thing that really gets me and really set me off to begin with was, on the 19th, on Friday, 4 days after they, you know, after they'd been at the house, they had the warrants now on the 19th, Lieutenant Brugos, who was in charge of the homicide team that was investigating the missing persons at that time case, Detective Dugal was under him, and that's who was the lead detective on the case. But here is Brugos standing outside the house while the other sheriff's deputies are going through the house and collecting items from the warrants and taking them out to, you know, to take them to their labs and all that stuff. He's standing there in front of everybody, and he explains that they had to get warrants, they had to have probable cause, and it's more than likely or not that a crime has been committed or something happened, or else the judge wouldn't sign off on the warrants, so they went and they got these warrants. They felt that something happened. They got that was the probable cause. They got the warrants. And then the very next sentence he says, but it's not illegal for adults to leave on their own. This is February the 19th, the very first day they're there. He's already made this case.
He states that. He's made his decision, right.
He's already made his decision. This is voluntary missing. That's it. Now, what they're going to do, now, in my opinion, what they did from there, all they did was take anything that would fit that scenario, and that's what mattered.
Mm-hmm. And all this time, you know your son, Joey, would not do this. He wasn't that type of guy, was he?
No, he wasn't. He would have, look, you know, I could have sat there and said, you know, I've talked to you before, we've been on, and like I've always said, he would have contacted his mother, his brother, me. He would have contacted one of them, not necessarily me or not necessarily his mother or his, but one of us, though. He would have definitely called if he was going to leave or do anything like that. So, but he, no contact whatsoever. You know.
Oh, you must have been going out of your mind.
Oh, I was.
You know,
I was boiling it for, you know, when I put that all together. And then I found out things like everybody else later about people being in the house and the house being clean in the time between, you know, the they were there on the 15th and then again on Friday the 19th. And that just, I became so infuriated with San Diego. It was like, one, you're already prejudging this case. Two, you never secured the house in the first place. So, three, people are going in and out of the house. What is going on? You know, that's when I called them the Keystone Cops.
Yeah, bad police work. Right. Well, let's jump ahead a little bit because we're going to talk about the trial, and you do need to be there, and everybody understands that. You want to be there, you need to be there in San Bernardino, hopefully when the trial starts on September 25th. But let's jump ahead a little bit. In the years between the 3 years that they were missing, a lot of suspicion fell. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead. You're doing fine. Go ahead.
Thank you. A lot of I shouldn't say a lot, but some of the suspicion fell on your son and you. It fell a little bit on Chase, too. But I remember people just absolutely convinced that your son, Mike, right, Michael? Just convinced that he had nothing to do with it. And that must have been just horrible. Oh, I can't even imagine.
That one was that was really hard to handle because anybody that knows Michael knows that Michael is, and I know people say this all the time, but Michael's not that type of person. Michael is, he's happy-lucky, he's a happy, you know, good person, he's gentle, and not to say that he's trained in a lot of martial arts and everything else, but he's not, he's just not a violent person like that. He's a, you know, he's more of a fun-loving big kid, you know. And his brother and he were extremely close, you know.
Yeah. It just must have been awful. I mean, there were books written about it, and you could just go on and on. But thank God that's been settled because nobody can say that now, and everybody needs to shut up because they've got the killer behind bars. Now, let's talk about Chase Merritt. He was a business partner, or was he an employee of Joey's?
No, he was basically what you would refer to as a subcontractor.
Okay.
Chase Merritt had several businesses in the past building and selling waterfalls. Now, from all the information we found and information that has been disclosed, and complaints that were filed as information that we now know and it's been out there all over. He would take deposits and then not finish products or take deposits and then the products weren't that good and he had trouble with customers and he had financial problems and different companies. Anyways, he had his own business, and he was he would physically make the phones. Well, Joey had his company, and he subcontracted to Chase. Joey would give him the designs and the specs and whatever, and Chase would build the fountains. Joey would work with Chase at times. He would go to the shop and actually build the fountains with Chase. But Chase
and he had a very
was no part of.
He had a very successful business.
Who, Joey?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Joey had an extremely he had just got contracts that were going to be worth about somewhere, I couldn't get the exact figure, but I can tell you it was between probably $8 and $12 million over the next 5 years in just two major contracts that he'd gotten.
Damn.
I mean, he was doing like, he was doing Paul Mitchell salons. They had already bought a bunch of fountains. He had done big-name lawyers' office, doctors' offices. He had done nightclubs, restaurants. I mean, these were, he did work for Hershey Chocolates. This was all over. I mean, he had good business. Let's put it that way.
Very, very, very talented man. And what a great idea.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
You would never think that the fountain business, the making of fountains could be so profitable. But, my God, $8 to $12 million contracts, that's great. Now, Chase Merritt, on the other hand, his subcontractor, that wasn't, like you said, that he was shady all along. All along he was shady.
Yeah.
Now, but Joey helped him. Didn't he? Didn't Joey help him along? And Chase.
Well, in 2009, go ahead. Mm-hmm. What you're leading into is in 2009 when Chase went to jail.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Chase had been in jail before and been in and out of prison and all that. And somewhere down the line, he had failed. He was on probation in 2009. He failed to comply with the court order.
Mm-hmm.
So in January of 2009, he had to go to court. He went to court, and the judge ordered him to jail for 60 days. Well, what he did is he ordered him to jail for 30 days, and he was out for 30 days, and he go back in for 30 days. Now, while he was in jail for both those periods of 30 days, Joey would go up and check with his wife, make sure everything was okay. He would give her money for groceries, for bills and all that, and he did that all that time while Chase was in jail. That's how Joey was.
He was that type of guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't you think there's some jealousy that Chase had about Joey? I mean, here's he's successful. He's got a family. And here Chase Merritt is older than he is. And I have my guess that he was jealous of what Joey had. Don't you think?
I don't know, Trish. All I can say is, you know, I can't condemn him for trying different things in business because he did several different things. But, you know, it's like Chase, to me, and according to all the conversations Joey and I had, I mean, Chase was very talented, okay? There was just something in him, I guess, that was the shady side to where he could never have anything really successful because he ruined it for himself in his business practices, you know? And so Joey comes along and gets these contracts. And, look, I know what kind of money Chase earned from my son. And I can tell you it was in the hundreds of thousands. And And so you're probably right. There probably was some jealousy there. You know, maybe he knew he could never make a success of himself on his own. He sees this guy that's, 10, 15 years younger than him come along and design this stuff and do all this stuff. You know, got good friends, got a beautiful wife, nice, great kids, you know. Yeah, maybe it was jealousy. I don't know.
Well, and when this was all happening, when the McStays were missing and nobody knew where they were and people were pointing the finger at your other son, Chase was a case player, as we call these people. He was out there. I don't remember a lot of suspicion going to Chase. Now, there are a few people that were adamant that Chase did it. They were very vocal on the internet, and it was all based on, like you said, we're talking with Patrick McStay, father of Joey McStay. Joey McStay and his family went missing. The police told Patrick, hey, they're in Mexico. We saw them go across the border. That's it. End of story. They're voluntarily missing, and they weren't. They were found murdered, and now Joey's subcontractor slash friend is on trial, will be going on trial for those murders. But anyway, you have Chase Merritt here who, was he borrowing money from Joey?
Well,
there was something going on there with the money. Fill me in on that.
Well, according to the records or in some of the other situations out there,
mm-hmm.
or talk, a conversation or on the internet, however you want to look at it, widely known, he was supposedly behind or didn't pay taxes, income taxes
mm-hmm.
on employees or whatever, and he was into the government for money, and then he was gambling heavily or he was addicted to gambling, I don't know. That's where the money situation, and he was into Joey for a lot. I mean, I know for a fact, I saw the paperwork, I was involved in conversations with Joey on it in 2008 and 2009. Chase cost Joey $31,000 on a fountain. That actually was built, well, it was built and made for a major restaurant there in L.A. And according to everything that Joey said from his notes that I've seen and everything else and from and emails from Chase, Chase was wrong on the measurements. And so the customer declined. Yeah, customer paid for the fountain. But then they, and Joey had paid to manufacture. This was all, done and ready, almost ready to go. And they went to their credit card holder, and it was back charged to Joey. And it ended up being, it was almost $34,000 fountain.
Oh, and do you know if Chase accepted responsibility for that, or did Joey just kind of blow it off for the sake of business?
Well, Chase didn't have the money. Joey put out the money, so what else is he going to do? He's just going to eat it, He was furious.
I've been really angry.
One of the reasons I know about that, for example, is because Joey and I were back and forth for probably 3 or 4 months
mm-hmm.
on the contracts that customers signed because of that fiasco. He wanted to redo the contracts. And so when it comes to the legal things, he always gets a hold of me, so... I mean, I've got tons of emails of him and I back and forth, redoing the contracts. And then, I change something onto the email to him. He changed something and email it back. I've got all that, stuff here, on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
Went back. So I know about that stuff,
Yeah, and I can imagine I think we're going to find out a lot that we didn't know as the trial goes on with Chase Merritt. We're going to get to discussing the trial and your ability to be able to be there during that time in just a moment. If I could, and I know this is painful and I apologize, but I want to make sure that everybody understands what you're going through and why it's so important for you to be there, because this was so senseless and so brutal that it just makes me sick to even think about it. But let's talk mm-hmm. about, didn't Joey and Chase have, was it a lunch the day before? Wasn't there some type of
conversation?
No,
it was that day.
Let's talk about that. What was the, do you know what they talked about, what was going on there?
No one really knows what happened. We have suspicions. I have suspicions of what happened.
What's your suspicion?
Well, I really don't want to go into that one yet.
Okay.
Because it involves some of the evidence, and I know that the defense is going to try to dispute that, so I don't want to
mm-hmm.
really get too
that,
much into
that's
that.
That's absolutely understandable. Last thing we want to do is do anything that will hurt when you go up on the stand. So later that night is when Chase Merritt came and took your son and his wife and your two grandchildren. Do you think he acted alone?
Yes, I do. I just have to agree with D.A. Ramos. When he said, I agree with him that it was very possible for one person to do it. Everybody seems on the internet. Oh no, they think it's more than one or somebody else. The only thing I'll say is this: if anybody helped I think it would be a case of after the fact, burying or something. But I don't believe anybody else was involved in the actual act itself.
Why would this man, Chase Merritt, destroy this beautiful family? What is his motive? Can you kind of give us a hint on that? I'm
assuming money is the only thing I can come up with. I have, you know, there's so many other things that I've learned and found through the years, you know, that I question, how can I say this? Let's just say people have tried to defend him, saying he's not violent. I've talked to people on the other side of the coin that say he did have a violent streak. I question if this is the only time.
Interesting. Well, it very well could find out that he has more skeletons in his closet than we are actually aware of. But it does seem like the only thing, and that's not a good reason at all, but the only thing that would drive a man to destroy his friend who's helped him and his wife and their two beautiful children would be some sort of discovering something that he has done is kind of the theory.
Well,
you know, that Joey discovered
Trish.
Something.
Yeah, okay. let me show you this. Okay. Let's say, hypothetically, okay? Let's say you have a criminal background. Let's say you've been in and out of prison several times, okay? Let's say we know that California has a three strikes law, that if you're arrested the third time, then, you know, whatever, you can file, depending on the circumstances, you spend up to life in prison, okay? So let's say you're stealing money, or you've started stealing money, and you cost someone you're doing work with money, and they find out about it, and they decide they're going to go to the police. And they're going to turn you
in.
There
you go.
And you know now that that could be life behind prison bars.
Life behind bars, absolutely. And that, to me, is, I have a feeling that's what's going to be all brought out. And talk about no kindness goes unpunished. I mean, Joey is good to this man, gives him a job,
him
money. You know, Chase screws up and costs him $31,000. Most people would fire that person and say, you're an idiot, get out of my life. But not your son.
Yeah.
Your son kept trying to help him.
Well,
and,
we talked we talked about changing welders. Joey called me and we talked about it. And I had told Joey basically to get another welder and split the work and see what that does. Chase gets the, you know, if he gets the, if he understands what's going on then, or he gets the idea, you know, and if he doesn't, then get rid of him. But, you know, give him the opportunity, because Joey's always been a fair person. But take a look at using another welder to end fabricator. I believe that Joey was probably, I believe that he was close to that point, you know.
And there,
because it wasn't
there you
just
go.
A case, this wasn't just a case of stealing money from him. This was a case of costing him money and a case of bad products going out. Or some bad products going on, you know, or repairs having to be made to these products. And that affected Joey's name. And the one thing Joey was not going to put up with was affecting his business name. Because he was very well known and very one of the elites in that kind of business. And Joey was a very honest person. He would do anything for you to make, you know, to fix something, replace it, because he was just that way.
And that, you're right. The last thing you want to do is tarnish your reputation because of somebody else's mistake or, you know, embezzlement or misrepresentation. Yeah. I mean, there's all these things that that can lead up to this. Again, the reason is absolutely ridiculous. And obviously that tells you quite a bit about what type of man Chase Merritt is. He's an animal, and that's an insult to animals. Let me just say this. He's a monster.
Yeah.
And any anybody that would kill children, anybody that would kill anybody like that is just an absolute monster. And Patrick McStay, this was your son, your grandkids, your daughter-in-law, and people on Web Sleuths and everybody who follows true crime. We all know how important it is for family members of the murderer to be at those trials. I mean, look at Mark Klass and Polly Klass. You have to be there for yourself and for your family. But what people don't realize is you have to literally pick up and move. And if you have a job, forget it. Got to take the time off or quit. And you have to pay for everything when you're down there.
You're right. The thing with me is, the only good thing is I'm retired, okay? Now, I've got a house, and I'm on a fixed income like everybody else, Social Security and that, you know, and everything. But I've got a house and everything else. So if I pick up and go to California, I've still got to support the house and utilities and all the bills here, you know, while I'm out there with those, you know, with bills out there and everything else. And I've got to have somebody in my house taking care of the house. And, you know, it's just there's a lot more to it. It's just not just getting on a plane and flying out there.
Right, and people don't realize that. Now, you have your book. Let's talk about your book. I would highly recommend everybody today, after hearing this, purchase your book. Let's talk about it. What's the name of it?
McStay's Taken Too Soon.
And it is a very intense, loving, you go through all kinds of emotions when you read this book. And I know you want to encourage people to buy the book, and I think they should just buy it flat out anyway, so you could raise some money to get to California. But I don't know if that's going to do it. So I'm putting this out there for you, Mr. McStay. I hope you don't mind this. But if there is anybody out there in the San Bernardino area that can help Patrick McStay come to San Bernardino and face the killer of his son, we would all be forever grateful. And we talked about this a little bit off the air. It's really hard to ask for money. And I want to float this out there. I think if you had a GoFundMe page, I think you would be surprised at how many people would want to do it, because it's so easy. You know, people just go on there, click, boom. They don't have to talk to anybody. They don't have to do anything, done. Do you think you might do something like that, or are you just hoping that the book sells? And you get it on Amazon, right?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. You can buy it on Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes & Nobles, you know.
You can get it everywhere.
Yeah, well, you can get it on my site, too. You can get it at mcstay.shop.com. You can go there, and it'll link you right to it.
Good, okay.
And there's a blog there we try to keep up to date, too, you know, and information there. So.
Good. And I would encourage,
matter of fact,
like I said,
your picture's on there on discussing and the information on the first interview we did back in February.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very sweet. Thank you for doing that. And I would encourage everybody to buy this, but it is a great book to read, first of all. And second of all, it will help Patrick McStay raise the money to get to California, to San Bernardino. But I know there's somebody out there that can help you, Patrick. I think about Sharon Rocha, Lacey Peterson's mom, Sharon Rocha.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
she had to leave Modesto, and I think it was Redwood City where she had to go. And she had a job, she had a life, and her and her partner had to pick up everything. Now, fortunately, they found a wonderful family that let them use their home for free. And that was a big part of it. That's what did it. This trial, especially with somebody like Chase Merritt, you don't know what kind of crap he's going to throw into the system that's going to make it come to a screeching halt. And
he could be out there
for months and months.
Oh, well, as a detective, you know, they interviewed the defense attorney, and like he said that it's scheduled to start on the 18th for the jury selection and a trial on the 25th. Mm-hmm. Well, his words were that he didn't believe that the opening arguments for the case would even begin until October. because, you know, and he's probably realistic. You know, I'm looking and thinking it's probably 2 to 4 weeks to see the jury, you know. And then you're probably, from all estimates I've been told and, you know, and what I've calculated, we're looking at probably a 3-month trial, and, you know, because it's going to be mostly forensics, you know, and circumstantial evidence and all that and all the forensics. And you know they're going to have that, you know, there's going to be evidence, there's going to be special, you know, experts on both sides testifying. And, you know.
Absolutely.
So it's going to be great. You know, it's going to be,
you want to be there to look in that scumbag's face.
You know, I want him to know I'm there. Here, I'm here. That was my son.
I'm not,
you know.
I'm not afraid
and
of
I,
you.
No, hell no. You know.
Right.
You know, I went after, you know, I went after him for all those years, you know. You know, we, look, there was a lot that I knew, a lot that I could not put in the book. A lot of things we didn't want to jeopardize anything. We didn't want people getting false ideas. So a lot was left out of the book. And not to keep it from it. And, you know, I wasn't trying to deceive anybody. I just could not take the chance that something, you know, would cause and this guy to get off. I mean, I can't do that, you know. And it was just, it was very, now one person, well, there was, it carries a 4-star rating, the book on Amazon. It carries a 4-star rating.
Yeah. It's great.
4 out of 5
I agree
stars.
With
yeah.
That.
And one person that bought the book wrote a comment. I think that, I don't know it verbatim or anything, but just roughly what the gist of what that person said was that they read the book and they thought it was an excellent book, and that minus some of the little grammatical errors, it, you know, which there were some, they felt that this was me talking directly to the purchaser of the book, the reader of the book. And they felt that this was, it was, you know, a book that everybody should buy. And that basically what this person, and I thought that was a great description of it.
That's a great description. In fact, I'm looking on it right now on Amazon, McStay's Taken Too Soon, A True Story.
Right.
Patrick McStay, Mr. McStay, did you feel all along that it was Chase Merrick that killed your family?
You know, I have to honestly say, Trish, no. I didn't know all along. There was, you know, it was one of those things where there were little things that kept popping up, okay? And in the back of your mind, you know, you're saying to yourself, you know, he's involved. He's in it somehow. Something's going on here. This doesn't jive, you know. Why was he doing this? It doesn't compute. You know, it was always there, okay? And I didn't want to say, you know, I made the list of 3 people that I suspected in the beginning, okay? Well, Chase Merrick was in my list, okay? But the list I put out, I didn't put him on it. And the reason I didn't put him on it, what people didn't know, is I was talking to Chase. I had communications with Chase. And I had to keep that line open, okay? For example, in 2014, in January, 2 months after their remains were found, I called Chase and asked him to do the CNN interview. That's why he was on CNN. Yeah, I asked him to do it. And he said, yes. He said, yes, Patrick, for you, I'll do it. And he did it.
Interesting.
And that's where the famous line came, where he says, I most definitely was the last person he saw.
He know that most definitely? I mean, that's such a stupid thing for him to say.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
God,
you would say,
know that.
Wouldn't you say, well, I believe I was the last person, or I could have been the last person he saw, or I don't know where he went after that. But when you say, and see, I went back and read that thing over and over and over. I've watched it. I've reviewed it because I have, you know, the CNN sent me the CDs and all that. I've got all that. I've been back over and watched it I don't know how many times, okay? Because somebody said to me at one time, said, no, he didn't say most definitely. I said, he said most definitely. I went back and listened to it 100 times. I went back and read the transcript. He says exactly, these are the exact words, quote, I most definitely was the last person he saw, end quote.
What kind of ego wants everybody to know he was absolutely the last person, but that pretty much tells everybody, well, guess what? You did it. How do you know? Unless, of course, you're the one that
how
killed
him. Yeah, how do you
them.
Know you were there? Now, let me tell you something. That conversation, I can't disclose all of it because there was a lot more to that. Because that conversation, and I can tell you, I can't remember. It was either January 13th or January 14th, okay, right in that period. Mm-hmm. Because it was like on a Monday or Tuesday, okay? Because when I got off that phone, he said, okay, you have to understand, I was already working with the producers at CNN. You know, I had already did one interview.
Right.
We did the one-hour special or so, okay? I got off the phone because they wanted him on, okay? That's when I went, I'll see what I can do, but I think he'll do it for me. They said, oh, God, please. Mm-hmm. So I went and I called him, okay? And that's when he agreed to do it. When I got off the phone, I called the producer at CNN and told her, and she said, I'm booking plane flights right now. We'll be there Thursday. Can you get a hold of him and tell him we're going to be there Thursday? When we want him on camera, we'll come. I said, yeah, I'll do that. I'll give him your number. And she said, fine, we'll get a hold of him. And I got off the phone, called Chase back, gave him the information. And this was like a Monday or Tuesday, okay? They were there interviewing him Thursday in California.
He wanted that. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where he
made
his famous
Uber. That conversation I had with Chase that day was 106 minutes long.
Alan, you can't tell us anything, can you? You can't tell us anything.
I got the phone bill. And I can tell you we went through a myriad of things.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you one thing we discussed. His book that he was supposedly writing, and everybody knows about it because he said it, remember? He said in Daily Mail and all these other places, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He read me chapters from his book.
Oh, he had chapters. Damn.
Yeah, he wanted me to work with him on his book.
Oh, God, this man is delusional. He killed your son and your grandchildren, and then, hey, buddy, come work on my book with me. Oh, my God, what a dirtbag.
Yeah.
It's just appalling to me. Now, like you said, you can't tell us everything that was said in that conversation.
No.
But after that conversation, were you then positive that Chase was the killer?
Yeah. Well, no. 2 days later, when he did the interview, that did it. You got to understand, Gina and I went back and forth. And then at the same time, I got a hold of him. You got to understand, he was in contact. He was allowing Gina to contact him because of me.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that Gina was working.
Okay.
So Gina was in contact with him. And she had emails back and forth with him and everything as well. She and I would then discuss everything that he said to her or he said to me. And she and I were just putting two and two together, and that interview and that week locked it down for us.
Oh, boy, that must have been hard. That must have been so hard, knowing this guy's out free. You're certain in your heart and soul that he's the one that killed your loved ones, and he's just walking around all arrogant, working on his book. So it was a couple of years, or was it like a year later, that they arrested.
Now, you were a little off on your dates. I think you said that they were found. I think you said November 13th. Their remains were found in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
That's incorrect. It was the 11th of November. So,
oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
No biggie. I just, you know. And then, as far as the date of the arrest, I think you said the 7th. That was the day. I think they may have had the the press release from the sheriff and all that.
Okay.
But he was actually arrested on the 5th.
Got it.
Because,
that's what you get for jumping onto Wikipedia.
He was arrested. He was arrested on the 5th, and I can tell you that very well because I got a phone call, and it was from Detective Sergeant Fisher, who was then in charge of the case. And he said, Patrick, I said, Sergeant Fisher, I forget his first name, it's Jeff. But anyways, we went by first names. And so he tells me who it is, and I said, yeah, he says, I wanted you to be the first to know. I'm in the car right now. We're heading back to San Bernardino. We just arrested Chase Merritt 5 minutes ago.
Wow. Oh, wow. That must have been some phone call. I can't imagine the emotions that you went through.
Oh.
You just run the gamut.
It was
happy,
a quick,
sad,
short
angry,
call.
All of that.
Yeah, it was a quick, short call. I really couldn't talk much after that. And he was in the car, and they were on their way back. Chasing another car because they had several carloads, and they were on their way back from arresting him.
Let's go back just a moment to the CNN interview where it locked it in for you, and he said he was absolutely sure he was the last one to see them alive. When was that? Was it shortly after they went missing? Was it a month after they went missing? When did that happen? When was the interview? The day.
When was the interview?
Around the day.
That interview was... Well, actually, it was filmed. I don't know if you got a camera or you're on your computer there. Can you tell me what day January 13th was of 2014?
I can get it for you real quickly here.
Yeah.
We should play the Jeopardy.
I can tell you
about
that day because it was a Monday or Tuesday that I talked to CNN and they got a hold of Chase.
Mm-hmm. Right, hold on. So it was October. I'm sorry, what, 2013
January,
or 14?
January 13th or 14th of 2014.
Okay, hold on.
I'm going off the top of my head. I'm usually pretty
accurate. Okay, January 13th, 2014 was a Monday.
Right, okay. I talked to them, I believe it was him, on the 13th. I then called the producers of CNN. They flew out, and I believe it was Thursday, which was 13, 14, 15, 16th, either the 16th or Friday the 17th, but I think it was Thursday the 16th. They were in California. They booked flights right away, and they flew to California. And they had him on camera interviewing him it was either on that Thursday or Friday.
So the bodies had been found, but he hadn't been arrested yet, obviously.
No.
Okay, so this is a few months after
later.
The bodies had been found.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. That's what I was trying to figure out was.
It
was that time. It was in they went missing in 2010. You had your doubts about Chase Merritt all through those years for 4 years, and then in 2014 in January it was solidified for you.
Well, I'll tell you now. Let me back up a little bit. In 2010, in the summertime, we really started having serious suspicions about Chase.
Mm-hmm.
It was that early, 6-7 months after, because we had always had contact with him. If he had a phone number or an email or something was wrong, he would let me know how I could get a hold of him. Well, for a period of time there, we lost communications with him. That really struck, that was one of the first things that really got me because, then we found a way, and we tracked him down again and found him again, and everything was okay, cool, no problem. But then that was also during the time later that same year when Dugal couldn't find him and wanted to talk to him. And he had already interviewed him and talked to him before, but this is Dugal with San Diego. He was the detective in charge of the case for San Diego.
That's right. He couldn't find Chase.
Right.
That's right. I remember
he couldn't
that.
Find Chase. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So he and I were emailing and back and forth on the phone probably once, twice, three, four times a week, during that time period. And I said, well, if you need to find him, I can find him for you. And he said, if you can find him. So I got all of Gina. She got on. It took about 2 weeks because this is during the period of time he was gone. And it took about 2 weeks to track him down. And we tracked him down and had a new number for him. And I turned around and called Dugal and gave him the number. And then some things transpired. That's when I was arguing with Dugal about Gianni and Joey and all of them not being on all of the FBI sites or the Interpol sites. And he was arguing with me that they were, and I was arguing they were. And, well, anyways, that's when through that period of time, I had given him a number. And then after that, that went on for about a month back and forth. And you know what the thing was? He found out I was right. They weren't on all the Interpol sites or all the FBI sites. They were on sites where you could go on as an officer or somebody in law enforcement, but for the public, they weren't. And so
that's pretty rotten.
Right. So when he finally gets back to me and says that that they are not on there, he doesn't say I'm sorry or you were right or excuse me or nothing. It's just like no big deal. And so anyways, that went on. He and I put the emails there in the book between he and I when I was doing, we were going back and forth on that. It's in the book. The actual emails between him and I are in the book. But that's when I asked him. Now, it had been about 2-3 weeks or so at least since Gina had tracked him down. We'd given the number. So he says, I asked him, I said, well, did you get all the Chase? He said, oh, yeah, I did. And I think it's in the book too, so I can say it too. As I asked him, I said, well, what do you have to say? So, well, I asked him what Joey was driving that day. Was he driving the Isuzu that day? And he said, Joey was driving the Isuzu. I said, oh, yeah. And I said, well, and he said, that's all. And I thought, that's all you asked him?
That's it? This number one suspect and you ask him one question? Oh, God. Oh, Patrick.
Well, I don't think he was a suspect to them. I don't think he was ever a suspect to them. I don't know. I have no idea what those guys were doing. I mean,
think that they still believed that Joey and Summer and your two grandchildren were in Mexico up until the day their bodies were found? Didn't they still believe that story, don't you think?
They never said that they didn't go to Mexico. Jan Caldwell, spokeswoman for San Diego Sheriff's Department, was interviewed by Randy Kay on the day, I believe it was the same day or it was within a day, of the San Bernardino Sheriff McMahon, when he announced, the arrest and all that, I think it was. But anyway, he's got the announcement. And all. Oh, no, it was the day that the remains were found. That was the day you're talking about, the 13th, when they did the press conference. He's up there saying, and one reporter asks him, he says, did they go to Mexico? And he says, we don't believe they did. They ever went to Mexico. Okay? At the very same time, Randy Kay is interviewing Jan Caldwell with San Diego Sheriff's Department spokesperson, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she's going through it all. We'll see the stack of book pages here. There's 4,000 pages, and we didn't miss. What people don't understand about those 4,000 pages, to get off a little off track a little here, is there could be two or three sentences on one sheet of paper.
On one page. Right.
On one
page.
So if you've got 4,000
like
pages,
right,
it might be 500 full pages.
Well, right.
I can tell you, I've got. If she's got 4,000, then I've got 50,000.
I can imagine. So they just couldn't bring themselves, or she as a spokesperson couldn't bring
themselves. Well, she says right there in that interview, Randy asks her, did they go to Mexico? And she said, yes, we still believe they went to Mexico.
Oh, good Lord. What?
Yes, you can see the interview. It's on CNN with Randy. I mean, she blatantly says right then, the very day, it says, they still believe it. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me.
That just makes them look ridiculous. It just makes them look silly because it's just, if it wasn't a horrible, awful murder, this would be hysterical. They're just deny.
Let me tell you what that says to me. That says to me, we're not good to admit we're wrong. We're never wrong, or we're gonna keep. We can't see it. Because you'll sue us.
Yeah, you go.
That says to me, San Diego saying, well, we're going to cover it up because we can't admit it because we do. We're giving you a lawsuit.
Yeah, because we didn't take it seriously.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what that tells me.
Oh, good Lord. How has San Bernardino been as far as you're concerned is handling the case?
Fantastic.
From when they got it? They've been good?
Fantastic. Let me tell you, Sergeant John Gaffney was the sergeant in charge of the homicide squad team that was handling the case in the beginning, you know, and Fisher came in later. But John Gaffney and I were on the phone back and forth many times. I have the utmost respect for Chris. It's Chris Fisher. That's the other one that called me on the arrest. Not Jeff, it's Chris Fisher. But Chris Fisher, John Gaffney, and a few of the others that I spoke to, I have the utmost respect for. Those guys are the top of the heap, man. If it's good cops, if there's cops that know what they're doing, if there's detectives that are the best, these guys are there. I'm telling you.
That's a relief.
They gave.
That's good.
John told me, he said, "Pat, in the beginning, he said, Patrick, I give you my word, we will solve this case." And he said, "We're all parents. We have children. We can't understand exactly what you're going through, but we know a lot of it, you know, because they did before." And he said, "I give you my word, we will solve this case," and they did.
He did. Oh, that's goodness you got to experience that law enforcement agency as well, because
night
the first
and day.
One. Yeah, yep. Night and day, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick, I want to thank you for coming on. We'll have you on again as the trial gets a little closer. I want to stress,
Trish, you asked me about an account or a PayPal account. GoFundMe.
That's right.
I don't have that, but I do have a PayPal account. And
let's
if anybody
talk about
wants
that
to
PayPal
help
account.
Out, yeah.
Let's talk about that. I'm going to write down the email address, and then I'm going to put it on the forum and put it everywhere. You know, when you go to PayPal, people, you go there and you have to put in an email address, and that's where the money goes to. So what is your PayPal account email?
pmixday@sbcglobal.net. And anybody wants to help, they can just go to PayPal and send money to that to the email. It'll go to my account. That's a trust account.
P. McStay and
at
the number two.
At SBC.
Oh no, I'm sorry. That was my.
No.
That was my bad.
P. McStay.
At
SBC. Yeah. SBCglobal.net.
Okay,
yeah,
we'll
and
put that on.
That goes into a trust account I have. That goes into a trust account I have set up.
And if anybody is in the San Bernardino area or surrounding area, California is wonderful as far as having programs to help people. Maybe there's a program out there where there is money set aside that's been donated to help family members of violent crime stay somewhere and be able to see the trial. If anybody in the San Bernardino area knows of some sort of crime victims fund that maybe Patrick McStay could use, that would be helpful too. Anything at all. But best thing you can do, you can donate to PayPal for Patrick McStay to go look Chase Merritt in the eye and just say, "I know you did it, you scumbags." Your email address is P as in Patrick McStay, McStay, at sbcglobal.net, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I'm glad you reminded me of that. I would have
been terrible. And anybody else out there, okay, and I know Trish, she's become more than just someone I talked to at Webster. She's become like a friend to me. Believe me, people, she's been Webster has been very good to me, and Trish has been very good to me. And I know it's hard for her as well, but she's having a situation with Webster's right now, and she needs donations sent into Web Sleuth. And I want you all, if you really care about Web Sleuth and it does a good job, I want you to go and donate to her site.
Oh, God, Patrick, I'm going to cry. That is so sweet. Thank you.
Well, it's true.
And I feel the same way about you. You've become a friend and somebody I admire a great deal, and I would do anything for it. God, I wish I was just rich. There's so much I could do if I had
we get a lot of
money
from one another.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I think we'll be able to get you to San Diego, get you somewhere comfortable, Patrick, and you'll be able to look that guy in the eye, that devil, that monster that did this to your family. So we'll get to
I appreciate
there, okay?
It. I want, appreciate it. I want to put a shout out to Bessie too. She's done a good job on this, like monitoring, taking care of.
She's wonderful. She is the best. And remember, you can go to Amazon and pick up Patrick's book. It's McStays, Taken Too Soon. And Patrick, we'll have you on again as the trial date gets a little bit closer, and hopefully it's solidified. I hope it doesn't go any longer than the start date of the middle of September. So we'll keep our fingers crossed there. But
for you, Trish, anytime. You just let me know.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. Thank you. You
okay.
Take care now, okay?
You bye-bye too. Now. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Patrick McStay, he and I had a conversation off the air about how difficult it is to ask for money. It's very hard, but he deserves to be in that courtroom and look that son of a bitch in the eye. I wish they would let him just take a slug, just take a, you know, I don't know, that's terrible to say, but do you remember Mark Klass? Mark Klass's daughter, Polly Klass, was kidnapped and murdered by that brute, that monster. I don't even want to say his name because Mark Klass never says his name either. Anyway, he's in the courtroom, and he's getting sentenced. And this guy is a lifetime pedophile. He was in and out of prison for rape and kidnapping, and why he was out when he kidnapped and killed Polly is beyond anybody's comprehension. So they're in court, and he's reading a statement. They're letting this jerk read a statement who kidnapped, obviously raped Polly, and even though there was no physical evidence because her body was too decomposed to get anything off of it, but let's face it, that's what he wanted to do. Kidnaps Polly from her bedroom, rapes her, kills her. He gets to read a statement. And you know what he says? This son of a bitch, bastard piece of crap says, and I'm paraphrasing, that he claims that Polly said, just don't do me like my dad does me. And when Mark Klass heard that, he jumped up and they had to hold him back. And everybody that sees that courtroom scene, you're all rooting for Mark to go right over that railing and just nail him. Just, oh, God, I get so mad thinking about it. But you know what they did? They made Mark leave. They made Mark Klass leave. This guy who rapes and kills his daughter and then accuses him of horrible things, of doing horrible things to his own daughter, they remove him. They should have picked the killer up by the neck and just dragged him out of there. Okay, I wish I drank because I could use a drink right now, but I can't drink. I've really tried hard to be an irresponsible alcoholic, and I can't. It makes me too sick. So I think I'll eat. That's what I'll do. Anyway, everybody, thank you, Bessie. Thank you so much for helping here behind the scenes. And Patrick McStay, we love you, man. Next week, it is going to be fun. Let me tell you, I'm having the guys on from BuzzFeed. I'll have more about that later in the week, though. It's going to be a wild show next week. That's all I can say. Okay, everybody, have a great week. Don't become one of my stories, please. Stay safe, stay out of trouble, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care now. Bye-bye.